in Tucson, Arizona, and this is 4/16/85, and we have another interview with a automotive designer whose name is John Middlestad. Middlestad, I'm sorry, Middlestead. Mr. Middlestad lives in Tucson, in the foothills, serene and dry area of Arizona. And we're going to ask him today to tell his career history in his own narrative and at his own pace.
Okay, thank you. Now we can just talk along here, right? Yeah. Okay. I'm one of the few people in the automobile design area that was born in Detroit, Michigan. Most everybody was born elsewhere. At the age of 9, we moved to a town called Pleasant Ridge, which is the north side of Detroit. And at the age of 5, I'm going to go back and forth here. At the age of 5, the art teacher at school said that I had extraordinary talent of coloring everything, and I should pursue art. So that was the first indication, and to my knowledge, that I had artistic background. Then as we progressed into high school and so forth, I got more and more into the art end of the thing and drafting. These two subjects I excelled in. And it seemed like way back then, I didn't know it, but that was the keystone of going into automotive design, because both things, art and drafting, are very, very important. So in the 30s, while I was in high school, I also had a influence from a man that was married to my cousin, and he had all the advertising for Ford and Packard Motor Company.
Remember his name?
Frank Williams. He had one floor of the Penobscot building, I remember that, and about 12 artists.
His own agency,
right. And so I was invited down many, many times to the studio and went to parties as a kid.
Must have been exciting.
With all these artists and so on. Some of them went on to be illustrators in New York after World War II, because advertising of cars during the war kind of pulled it. But I was really influenced because I saw some top-notch work. Now, I think the ads date back to the time when Ask the Man Who Owns One and different cliches were used. Remember?
Slogans.
Yeah, slogans, yeah.
Right.
So anyway, that was a very much of an influence.
Did you work for Mr. Williams? No.
No, because this was in high school.
Ah.
And World War II was coming about and so on, and after high school, I went to Cranbrook Academy of Art, and took fine art and design at Cranbrook, and then was drafted.
This is in Bloomfield Hills?
Yeah.
What type of experiences did you have there at Cranbrook?
At Cranbrook, I worked studied under a fellow named Marshall Fredericks, who was a sculptor.
Very well-known sculptor.
Yeah, and his man was Carl Millis, who did the fountain.
M-I-L-L-E-S.
Yeah.
Did the famous film there.
Yeah, and he's was a Swede or something.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
I guess it's still in existence.
Oh, yes, still there, yes.
And
Frederick is a Dane.
Yeah. But it was in his early days he taught there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was a fellow named Mitchell that was another instructor there. So I had the two. So anyway, from Cranbrook, then I was in.
One more question. Did either of these gentlemen contribute to your? Obviously, they did to your appreciation of art and drawing.
Oh, definitely.
Can you elaborate on that a bit? Mr. Frederick, especially.
Well, again, he was a very, very, very good craftsman, and gosh, he could sit down at a board and design anything. Mm-hmm. But
had he gotten into sculpture at this point?
He did some.
He did some.
Yeah. Yeah. But as it went on, this is a little side issue.
Yes.
Back in the early 50s, we had Marshall Fredericks commissioned to do a mercury head for us.
Can you tell us a little about that commission while we're talking about Fredericks?
Well, we thought somebody from the outside could do this head very well.
Was someone in the design department?
Yeah, the design department.
Do you remember who was the spearhead of that particular episode?
Well, let's see, who was in charge of it? I think Bill Schmidt was in charge of the mercury at that time.
Was he?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The reason I ask is because we have it at the museum.
Do you?
Yes. In fact, it's in our office.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
The original mercury head.
But he sent a bill for us, and so on, and we thought, good grief, we could have done this here.
Do you remember how much it was?
No, I don't.
Ballpark figure?
No. Back in those days, it could have been $400.
Okay.
Which was, it probably was, back in those days. So if I'm getting away from myself.
That's all right.
But anyway.
It was used as a promotion.
I think personally that I had more influence with the advertising business with my cousin's husband than I did with Cranbrook.
Mm-hmm.
Because I did fine art there and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And my cousin always said, why bother with fine art? Because he says you have to make a living. Somewhere along the line you have to make a living. So he was right. Because fine art, you can go to any art school, and 80% of the students in any of these university art schools are fine art students. And you say to the professor, how are you going to get these guys jobs? They don't know. So I always have been a thing to listen to the cousin and say, gosh, you got to make a dollar here and there.
Was this Mr. Williams?
Yeah. So anyway, then I went into the service. Do you want to get into the service?
Yes, tell us some of your experiences.
And I went into the combat engineers and worked on in the art area of the paper and so on. But from basic training in Camp Rucker, Alabama, we went to Tennessee Maneuvers. Do you want to know anything about this?
Sure. Yes.
All right. Tennessee Army Maneuvers. And from Tennessee to California Desert Maneuvers. And near the Desert Center here in California.
Mm-hmm.
On our way from Tennessee to the desert, we stopped at Tucson. And I was 19 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember getting off the train and having donuts and coffee from the Red Cross and seeing the A Mountain. Did you see the A Mountain?
Mm-hmm.
You can see them. And Tucson was nothing at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I remember just the A Mountain because the outside of town.
Mm-hmm.
So then we went to the desert, and from there I was chosen to go on a cadre, which is non-commissioned officers, and we went back to Alabama. And from there to New York and overseas, to England, so on. So we saw combat in the in World War II during the Battle of Bulge.
Oh, in the Battle of Bulge.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we put up bridges under fire and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Minefields and so on.
You
minefields.
Minefields.
Yeah, bridges and roads.
And roads.
Huh? Yeah. Not too great. But anyway, after 3 years in the Army, then I came back and went to the only art school in Detroit that was not fine art, and that is not in existence anymore. But at that time, it was the Center for Creative Studies, and it was called Meinzinger.
How do you spell that?
M-E-I-N-Z-I-N-G-E-R.
Where was it located?
on Woodward Avenue, near the boulevard. But it was the only school, and they had a course in design, advertising, lettering, fashion design. It was pretty good at the time. And so anyway, that's what I did. And during the time I was going to Meinzinger, I remember my mother doing some church work and calling on a young lady that was in Ford Hospital with TB. And so anyway, she told me, she says, I've talked to this young lady, and she says her husband is an artist also. I said, oh. And she says, well, yeah, he is designing cars for Packard Motor Company. And you two guys ought to get together. So I went down to see the gal in Ford Hospital. She was a kind of a live-in there. And he had worked for Ford in, I think, I have to get the dates here, 48, I think, 47, 48, by the name of Bob Jones.
Bob Jones.
Yeah. And he had left Ford at that time to work for Packard. And I think those days you went for $100 more a month. So he went to that, and he gave me some names to see at Ford. And he said, why don't you take a look at my portfolio? So I did, and I've always been interested in cars. I think back into the early 30s, and when I used to look at these ads that the cousin used for Ford, with the fenders and everything else, I think all of us that ended up in design would used to put a piece of tracing paper over cars and redesign them, do away with the bumper and the fenders and so on. So we did that. And you say, what was my interest in cars? I think we used to draw too many cars, really, and during class with work, so on. And so anyway, I looked at this portfolio, and it was down my lines, and I said, my gosh, this, back in those days, you weren't conscious of how to get into the car business as much as you are now, with all the publicity and the schools dedicating themselves to that. So anyway, I made a portfolio. I worked about 6 months on the portfolio. And I had 2 years in at Meinzinger, and interviewed with Ford Motor Company in 49, and was hired in 49. By a fellow named by Bill Schmidt.
He was the person who interviewed first.
Yeah, and it was just after the same week that I was interviewed. It was when Oswald and Snyder left.
John Oswald and George Snyder.
Yeah, they just left.
They had come over from General Motors.
No, they had just left Ford Motor Company.
But I mean, initially they had come over.
Oh yeah. Yeah,
they had been part of the General Motors.
Right, it was Gregory, and I think Nature told you that.
Yes.
It was Gregory, and then Oswald Snyder, and when they left, and I don't know how long that they were there, not too long, and they were in disfavor of some sort, and
who was running the design center at that time?
Well, they called on an engineer by the name of Charlie Waterhouse. And Charlie Waterhouse had just got his job. And at that time, the thing was, Bill Schmidt was Lincoln Mercury, Bob McGuire Ford, and Gil Spear was Advanced. And that's how it was broken down.
This is 1948?
49.
Oh, 49. And George Waterhouse was the administrator.
Charlie Waterhouse. He was a manager.
Where was Gene Bourdonnais at this time?
Gene Bourdonnais was, he could have been Mercury. I said to Lincoln Mercury, I think that Schmidt had, that is really, really difficult exactly to pinpoint where Gene was at that time.
It's not really that important.
No. But I remember, Gene was an assistant manager.
To Waterhouse?
Yeah.
Okay. And Najar.
I'm sorry, boy, I've really boo-booed here.
That's all right.
Because when I went in 49, I interviewed with Bill Schmidt, but when I went for the job, Gene was the first one I saw.
Okay.
And I'll bet you he was 27 or something like that at that time.
Uh-huh.
And real good-looking guy.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, the first...
What sort of questions did they ask you about Bill and Bill Schmidt and Bourdain when you interviewed them?
When I interviewed with Bill Schmidt, and I didn't interview with Bourdain. He just met me the first day and assigned me.
Uh-huh. But Bill was your first...
Mainly your portfolio speaks for itself.
That's good.
Yeah. And if you had a good portfolio and you could draw cars well, you can do that type of thing.
Do you remember anything that Schmidt said to you during that interview? Anything stick in your mind?
No, I wish I did, because I just think that Bill was a personal guy, and he said, I kind of like what you've got here.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing that sticks in my mind that much, except he seemed to be enamored.
Yeah.
Okay. And when you went in at that time, they assigned you to the advanced studio under Gil Spear. And back in those days, you could almost design anything you want. I think you heard that from a lot of people. I don't know.
Mm-hmm, sure. You can elaborate on that if you can. How'd that work?
Well, at the time, they were talking about no wheel cars, air suspension, this and that, and rocket ships. And
it's a time of experimentation.
Yeah, and I think that even back in as a kid, that we were all Buck Rogers oriented, and Flash Gordon. And the finest artist, I think, around at that time did the cartoon of Flash Gordon. His name was Alex Raymond. And we all admired that artwork.
Mm-hmm.
Surprising how certain artists affect you, you know. So, anyway, now we are now in his advanced studio. And so I was assigned to just do a car.
Gil Spear was the head of the advanced studio.
And I remember doing this car, my first attempt at this thing, and I did the thing, and everybody was so enamored with it. It had two tubes in the back for the rear end and so on, that the rendering itself ended up early in my career in Charlie Waterhouse's office.
Mm-hmm.
So I was... interviewed again by Bill Schmidt, that he said, I'd like you in my studio. So it's only been 2 months I've been in advanced, and I'm now working for Bill Schmidt
and
Dave
head.
Ash.
Yeah, they were the head of which studio?
Lincoln Mercury.
Lincoln Mercury, and Dave Ash was the second in command?
Nope, that didn't work that way. There was Bill Schmidt, he was a section supervisor.
Uh-huh.
And in that studio we had hard, you used to do that in the old days, hard and soft trim, which means an instrument panel studio where you did nothing but instrument panels and accessories. And then you had another studio that did soft trim, seats.
Seats?
Only.
Mm-hmm.
Seats. And then
you say the hard trim, you mean the interior trim?
No, the hard trim is usually instrument panels, because
that's
usually was termed hard,
okay.
Hard trim.
Soft,
you got soft was the fabric and the seats.
Seats.
Yeah. And then along that was an exterior studio.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember back in those days, the exterior, and I'm sure everybody's told you this, that there was no such thing as Dynoc. And they did clay cars.
Can you spell that and tell us what it was?
Dynoc?
Mm-hmm.
That's the plastic film that goes over a clay surface.
Which isn't used today, but...
Yeah.
How do you spell it?
D-I-N-O-C.
Fine. So you did not have that
no.
At that time.
So anytime you did a clay car, it painted, they had paint shop came in and painted it. And then you take it someplace and it would start to crack. So those were old days. Then we had template makers back in those days.
What is a template? T-E-M-P-L-A-T-E.
Yeah. Template makers would be people that came in and took dimensions off the car and the profiles and then put them on paper. But they would cut cardboard to go around. We now have, as you know, the scanner. Did they talk about the scanner?
Bit, yes.
Yeah.
But in those days it was template. So that would be cardboard?
Yep.
Well,
they'd cut various sections every so many inches right through the car. And these guys were kept busy. We had quite a template crew.
Now the template would be the door handles? Or?
No. The template would be the cardboard that would show you the shape of the car at various sections.
I see. It would have to be fairly plastic or fairly malleable to be able to fit the curves.
Well, he'd cut it to fit the curves.
Okay. Good. I've never really quite understood the template situation.
Did they?
Well, yes, we've talked about it. But in my own mind, I need to know exactly.
Didn't Johnny tell you that?
Oh yes, but for my own perception, I need to know exactly how those templates work. Can you elaborate on that a bit?
Okay, now.
In visual terms.
Now, in the modern thing, the scanner, you have a bridge, and the car is in the bridge. And you have a little needle that goes right down the surface of the car, all the way down from top to bottom, and it records the ins and outs of this. Well, back in the old days, the fellows would put the template, and they'd have to cut cardboard and section that car. And then they'd take the cardboard and put it on a drafting table, and they would get the contour.
Uh-huh.
Okay? Does that explain?
I think, and then what would they do with it?
But they do it every so many inches.
I see.
All the way through the car.
Uh-huh.
And that would get, that's the only way you could get it.
Exterior or interior?
Exterior.
Okay.
And
then you would put it on the clay with some sort of adhesive. Well, the clay itself would be an adhesive, right?
No, the clay would be just clay.
How would you make the
template? Would be to put a piece of cardboard sideways.
Uh-huh.
And then cut the cardboard to fit the contour of the car.
Uh-huh.
I think that's...
Take a fender. How would you do that?
The same way.
How would you make a template for
same
a
way, same way.
But cardboard is flat. How would you make it curve?
You're taking the cardboard and you're holding it sideways or, and then you're cutting it.
Uh-huh.
You don't do this.
Yeah.
You do it sideways.
I see.
Right angles to it. You don't.
I do see, but go ahead.
You don't really?
I think I do, but I want our listeners to be sure that they know exactly what the template did. In oral terms.
In oral terms,
yes.
Yeah. Well, a guy would hold up a rectangle piece of cardboard. And start cutting away the surface of the cardboard at the point it would hit the clay.
Mm-hmm.
And you keep cutting the cardboard more and more until it fit snugly against the clay and followed the contour on the leading edge of the cardboard template. And that would give, and they would be very good cutters and sharp scissors. And when you finish up, and they do it at every 4-inch sections or something like that, all the way through the car. Mm-hmm. And you come to a fender, and the same thing applies.
Right.
You have a side template, and you have a top template, and then you marry the two.
But when you get to the crown, where you have
then
a curve.
Then he would do a one from the top.
He would simply bend it.
No, because it's always at right angles.
I'm thinking of
to orderly do this and thing and so forth, but you've got to remember that you're not using cardboard flat against the car. You're using it at right angles.
Oh. It's for a visual effect then.
That's right.
Oh,
suppose I wanted a template of, I push this thing at the back here and start cutting away that surface until this point hit the top of the seat and that one at the bottom, so I'd get that curve. That's hard to explain.
Let's
we're not laboring on this thing, templates versus scanner and so forth. But these are things that we did. As I was in the instrument panel section and so forth, we did all the accessories for Lincoln Mercury. In those days, we did sun visors out exterior, and spotlights, and rear view mirrors, and special wheels, and so on.
And when you say you did them, how did you do them?
We rendered them.
You rendered them?
Yeah.
Okay. That means
from the mind into the paper.
Right, okay, good. And that means a final drawing, not a sketch. A rendering,
there's a sketch on tracing paper, and then the rendering goes from there. And back in those days, we did it on black paper or colored paper with airbrush.
With airbrush?
Yeah.
Not with colored pencils?
Both.
Both. Okay, good.
Both. Sometimes we did a lot of things with Prismacolors.
With what?
Prismacolors, which was a colored pencil.
How do you spell that?
P-R-I-S-A.
M?
M-A.
M-A. Prisma.
Yeah, Prismacolor.
That was the manufacturer's name?
Yeah.
It wasn't a generic type of pencil?
No.
So it was simply a colored crayon pencil?
Oh, yeah. But we used a lot of airbrush in those days. We did full size.
Was airbrush fairly new in the 40s? Fairly new technique?
No, that was in the early 50s. That's what everybody used. You were issued a airbrush and Prismacolors.
Like a pastel or a watercolor?
Yeah, it's done on black paper, and it we did back in those days full size cars. In airbrush.
Forgive me, when you say airbrush, do you mean it was you mean the paint was forced by some mode of action through a brush?
Well,
the
yeah.
A
little airbrush is like a pencil, except that you have about 30 pounds of air going through it.
Right.
And a paint cup that's attached to it, and you...
So the air and the paint is forced
right,
out through the brush.
Right,
right. At your direction, you control the pressure.
That's right, and you fail.
Good.
So back in those days, we did full-size airbrush drawings of cars, instrument panels, steering wheels, most everything was airbrushed.
All of this had to be carefully rendered.
Yes.
Visually.
Yes.
Before it could be.
Yeah, then we had to show this to management, just like they do today.
And would they, once you've gotten the final renderings, at least the near final renderings, then you'd have to present it as a as parts of a vehicle,
right?
To the
right
to this styling committee.
Yes, right. Like today is steering wheel day.
Right, exactly.
We'd have an instrument panel.
All your drawings.
Yes, right, and lettering day, and.
But the styling committee consists of both body engineers and the.
Back in those days, yes.
Right.
Yeah. So, anyway. Where do you want to go from here?
Well, I'm sorry about the interruption, but
okay.
I feel that this is important that we detail exactly what you're talking about.
Oh, okay.
So that's why I interrupted you with
all
the
right,
technical details.
Fine.
So let's go.
I guess what bothers all of us is that we are so it's so natural for us to talk about this
right,
that the average person doesn't know it.
But it's helpful to me and helpful, I think, to our listeners. No, start then with the movement that you made from Gil Spears Advanced Studio to Bill Schmitz and Dave Ash's.
Yeah, and
you were about to say just what Dave Ash did.
Well, he had instrument panels, and we had a fellow named Don Byrus.
How do you spell that?
You would ask that. I don't know. He went to Chrysler, and I don't know whether he's still a
R-U-S?
I think so. He had soft trim. And a fellow named Bob Whelan had the exterior of the Mercury. And
W-E-I-L-A-N-D?
Yes. And a fellow, as you know, Don Della Rosa had the Lincoln.
Lincoln? What?
Car.
The whole car?
Exterior.
Exterior, okay.
Yeah. And we all worked for Bill Schmidt.
Okay, good.
And then on the other side, the Ford side, I think there was Bob McGuire and Art Querfeld and John Najar had the hard trim over there. He was a counterpart to Dave Ash at that time.
Uh-huh.
Of course, we move around so.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
That was at that time.
Right.
That month.
The early 50s?
Yeah.
Okay.
And one of the interesting things I did at that time was that Gene came back and said we have
Mrs.
to
coordinate.
And this is 51, and the Korean War was going, and so anyway, they sent myself and a fellow named Bill Mason, who was went to Chicago a couple years after that. But anyway, the two of us went to the tank arsenal and represented Ford Motor Company in design of some specialized tank equipment. And I think the project was about a month, and we it was very high security stuff, and the tank people had some ideas, but they wanted them to put it be put on paper. And typical of what they wanted rendered was my project was to render a control tank with satellite tanks, unmanned, that would be radio controlled to go over any terrain. So we had to illustrate these things. Another fellow had a piggy bank tank that had an extra engine, so that if one engine went, they could put another one in without too much trouble.
This was sort of the advanced studio of the
Tank arsenal.
The tank arsenal.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. But we are highly under security.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was an interesting thing, and I think we did a good job for Ford on that one.
Did Ford have any tank contracts that you worked on?
No, because of the fact that, not that I know of, mm-hmm. I wasn't, what I do know is that two of us went from Ford, two from Chrysler, and two from General Motors. So there are six designers there. That much I do know. And, but who got the contracts, I don't know. Because I think Chrysler had a few contracts.
They were the big tank producers, weren't they?
Yeah, right.
So as far as you know, your designs got into final production?
Only some modifications of a of their latest tank at that time. So, you want to stop that thing, right?
Sure.
So after 1 month at the tank arsenal, I went back to my regular duties doing Lincoln and Mercury instrument panels, steering wheels. All the studios at various times had extra work to do. Sometimes we had, as a sideline, if we weren't too busy, we would pitch in and do some exterior design along with our whatever. Every studio did various things. The soft trim under Don Byers at that time had a man named Art Miller and Reg Bennett and Vern Brettmeyer. And these were old artists, illustrators, Brettmeyer. And these were old illustrators that
old
did
point of service.
Well, they were probably the older ones in the design thing, but they had a lot of experience behind them, but not too much car experience. But they did the soft trim, and in those days they did it all with airbrush, and usually every rendering of a soft trim seat design, either standard or deluxe.
So this group would do the final rendering of your initial designs?
No, they were in the soft trim. I'm just going around the studio and telling you what was interesting that they did, because the soft trim people, you can get pretty bogged down just doing soft trim, because you just do seats and after seat after seat. And you did the whole interior kind of like you had two doors, four doors off the thing, and you look into the rendering and you see the back seat and the front seat and a little bit of the instrument panel, not much. But those fellows would make their job more interesting by putting these fancy backgrounds in through the windows. And remember Vern Breckmeyer did one of the Taj Mahal. Mm-hmm. And I think they spent more time on the goddamn rendering of the, what you saw through the window than they
what,
did.
What was in the foreground?
Nothing. You saw the seats.
Okay, fine. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You look through the you look at the seats, and if you were lucky enough, you saw the design of the seat trim. But mainly through the windows, we'd have all this going on. And everyone would try to outdo themselves in those days, putting various types of things back there. I remember Bob McGuire had a famous one of a beach scene with some gal running towards the water, mm-hmm. with not much on. So anyhow.
These were internal.
Yeah. No, not internal. They were presented to management at that time. Sure. They were not internal.
But they were not published.
No.
So you could get away with that sort of thing.
No? Yes, we had a lot of fun in those days,
right.
Because we could put things in. Mm-hmm. And made quite a thing out of a rendering. The rendering at that time sometimes would take a week, mm-hmm. to do one rendering, mm-hmm. of a proposal. And let's see, where do we want to go from here?
At that time,
Charlie Waterhouse, and then we George Walker was a consultant with two men, Elwood Engel and Joe Orr's. They did not belong to Ford Motor Company, but they had access to us and gave their opinions and so on. At that time also, sometimes George would have his crew at his office do some competitive things.
What was the big push here in the 50s? What were you working on?
I think the 50s can... new and innovative type things, as you know, that the Victoria with the roof panel that went back was new. I think we used to be on a 3-year cycle at that time, the 52, 53, and 54. Ford and Mercury were together. We were on that 3-year cycle. And you'd have the first year, and then we'd work diligently on getting the minor changes to every year. So we'd work a whole year on just getting moldings and grills and ornamentation.
You're still in the Lincoln Mercury studio.
Yeah, and we were working on instrument panels, of course. And as I said, once in a while you do extra work in the other studios.
Oh, you would? Huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you give us sort of a thumbnail sketch of a typical day in the Lincoln Mercury studio under Bill Schmidt, and your relationship with him and your relationship with the other members of the staff?
I think it was back in those days that we were all young. I think that we were, we did not have the government situation. I think we were...
in other words, you were regulation free.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was a lot of fun and camaraderie. I think there was only 250 in the whole design area at that time.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That includes the shops and everything. Mm-hmm. Everybody knew everybody, and we when we had a Christmas party, we could do it in one big room,
mm-hmm.
the whole group. I remember I don't know whether anybody has told you this, but Bill Schmidt was picked to go to be on TV back in the days that it was Ed Sullivan. And Schmidt was supposed to be on TV Sunday, and we got a communication on this thing, and we were all to watch Bill give his little pitch on the Mercury. And Ed entered.
The new Mercury?
Yeah, for...
What year was that?
I think 52, I think. Mm-hmm. So anyway, Ed Sullivan introduced Bill Schmidt, and it was in days of live TV, and Bill Schmidt froze. And
Couldn't speak.
And it's kind of a side issue there.
Did he ever get the message out?
I don't think so. I don't think he did.
Really?
No, that's right.
And Ed waved him.
Yeah, he turned kind of into a black and white. You can see him almost getting whiter by the minute.
But well, Bill has a kinescope in there.
I don't know. Be interesting, but oh God. We've had a few incidences like that. So anyway, from the in that studio, then I went in 1953, I think, to I gotta back up here, because it has to do with the designing of the Atmos. But
yes, I'd like to hear. I suspect that both the Advanced Studio and the Lincoln Mercury Studio had a lot to do with those early Dream cars.
Yeah, now the Dream cars, I think that, and I'm not going to try to take any credit away from Joe Orr's or something, but I think he did one of the first Dream cars called the X100.
Mm-hmm.
And
which is in the museum's collection.
Is it?
Yes.
Okay. But the only thing that I think I contributed in that was that first piece of artwork or design that I did that was in Charlie Waterhouse's office, because it had that type of rear end.
Mm-hmm.
Then in for the 1950s.
These were concept cars, were they?
Yeah.
Advanced concept.
Right. And then in 1953, I worked on exterior. I was in the exterior studio.
In which?
Again, under Dave Ash, Bob McGuire.
So you moved from the interior to the exterior studio in the Lincoln Mercury.
Nope. I went to Ford.
Ah.
We were bouncing around quite a bit.
And you moved to the Ford studio, Ford exterior.
Ford exterior, okay. Right. And one of the things in 1953, we went into the new building.
The new Exterior and Engineering Center.
Yeah, it was brand new in 53, remember? Mm-hmm.
And on Oakwood Boulevard.
Yeah, so I was... Bob McGuire had all of us, he said, now if you take five men that are designing, and you said you'd lose one guy per month and let him work on a special project of whatever he wants to do,
mm-hmm.
just like this guy has gone away, see what he comes up with. So at that time, I did some sketching and some drawing and a full-sized rendering of what was going to be the 1953 Dream car.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, I had a side view and full size rendering, which is in the airbrush. So
in other words, you were asked to do a special advanced concept vehicle.
Yeah, just let yourself go.
Let your imagination run wild.
And I think more things are developed during those times than any other time, mm-hmm. but anyway. So I thought of if you think about flying saucers at that time, so I developed a car that was had a canopy, a glass top, and quite a modern thing with automatic road sensors and a thing called wrist twist steering, which does away with the steering wheel.
How
does
that work?
I'll get into that. And fins. We had quite a thing in 53, and we high fins. So I went to the Chicago Auto Show and so on. It was the next thing to the X100. At that time, being I was in Ford studio, I did that Atmos, but around that time, Bill Schmidt did a double canopy car for a show also.
Mm-hmm. He was still at the Lincoln Mercury studio.
Yeah. Right. So anyway, the innovations that we used in the Atmos was the wrist twist steering, and later in my career, in 60, 10 years later, engineering had worked out a wrist twist steering on a Thunderbird, and I had a chance to drive that. It's variable ratio, and they had one on a regular vehicle that we could drive around. It proved to be a too novel a thing. People just couldn't get I don't think, used to that type of thing, but it was the way we were thinking back in the early 50s.
Can you describe the wristless driving device?
Yeah, it was like a pistol grip, two grip pistol grips, and with variable ratio, and it would turn swiftly. I had no trouble with it, but I think it, in the long run, the steering wheel up, of course, is the thing. But who knows?
Who knows? Did you make a full drivable prototype of the Atmos?
No. That was only in fiberglass. It was one of the first fiberglass that Creative Industries did.
Now, was it full size?
Yes. Yes.
And did it include Bill Schmidt's double?
No, he did. Cabin. That was another car.
Okay, this is called the FX Atmos. Do you remember what the FX meant?
It was just the Atmos, far as I know.
The Atmos, ATMOS.
Yeah. Yeah.
And but you did build a mock-up of the grip.
Yes. Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Full size.
You betcha.
Okay.
That was in the original concept.
How did they work? You just turned them right or left?
That's right.
But if you wanted to go right, did you turn both of them right?
If you went to right, you go clockwise.
Okay. With
left counterclockwise, with both of them.
This is the right wheel and the left wheel. So
yeah.
Like
yeah. Okay, right. Good. Or one at one.
Right.
They were both synced.
Yeah. Okay. Good. But you didn't have anything that propelled you around the studio. It was a stationary mock-up.
Yeah. That's right. But
you didn't have wheels on it that would, on the mock-up that would turn as you turned the.
No. We had nothing. That was in the early days when we didn't do too much mock-up. It was just the concept.
Okay, good.
And
what sort of reception did this get from your colleagues?
It was quite far out.
Yes.
For its time, yeah. And I think it probably still is, because it had a different seating arrangement. The driver sat in the center, and he had two passengers behind, and so on. That the whole thing was kind of Buck Rogers-ish.
Now, how big was the Atmos mock-up compared to the Atmos model?
The full size.
It was full size.
And I can't be. It was the as large as a Ford, I think.
Can you describe the exterior? Did you have the full reign on that?
Yeah.
Do you remember some of the exterior innovations that you had?
Well, the exterior, we used some stainless steel for design. We had a light in the front that was a bar light. Instead of the headlights, it had a full width bar.
A horizontal bar light.
Horizontal bar light.
Uh-huh. In the middle of the hood? Or?
Yeah, between the two fenders.
Uh-huh.
And we had automatic sensors, road sensors, which...
What are road sensors?
Okay, we mentally you'd think, okay, if you had a highway that goes across country, and you say, if you had little stations all along that road that you could... key your car into just by radar and so forth. You just say, okay, I will plug my automatic sensor thing, and then they would pick up impulses from the side of the road. And
what would they tell you?
And then you could automatically put on things, so you wouldn't have to even steer. It would automatically take you there.
Ah, okay, but you have to have a complicated network of.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Okay. The way we thought in those days is something else. But who knows? You know, sure. Levicar had no wheels, and they had a mock-up of that.
Yeah.
I think Andy Kuchar was a great guy on that, but that didn't go anywhere either. So.
I'm not anyway putting you down.
No. But we thought of these things.
Yeah.
And.
What sort of reception did it get from your superiors? The Atmos?
Oh, yeah. It was generally liked.
Pictures were taken, and I think releases were made.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. The following year, a guy named Bill Boyer did a thing called the Mystere.
Mystere?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was for the next year's Chicago show.
Oh, was the Atmos exhibited in one of the Chicago shows?
Yeah.
Or one of the automobile shows?
Oh, yeah.
Which one?
Chicago.
And then it
traveled around. I can't recall, but the Chicago, it used to be in the early 50s, Chicago was the biggie.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to all go there as designers and stay near the Stockyard Inn, and that's where the show was.
I see.
And it used to be a yearly thing that we would go to.
Do you remember the response you got from the Admirals, from your friends and colleagues in the business?
I think they, as I said, I think they, some of them thought it was too far out.
Was it?
Yeah.
It took a lot of kidding about that.
Well, at times, yeah, because of the glass canopy and so forth. And
there's a single canopy?
How do you get, yeah.
A single passenger?
Yeah, with a V in the top. And it had a entrance problem because you'd have to, it would be like the gull.
Right.
Top, you'd have to, the canopy would come up, you get in, and the canopy come down, and so forth.
You had to.
Which was quite a complicated thing, but who knows when you're dreaming.
Sure, that's great. Well, you were proud of that, obviously. You should have been.
Yeah, that's right. That was one of the, you know. And from that, it led up to 1955, when George Walker...
Forgive me, what year was the Atmos?
It was in the 1953 Chicago Auto Show.
Now you're not going to jump 2 years out here.
No, I'm trying to think of what we did, so many grills and...
What were you doing in the years between 53 and 55?
Well, let's see...
You stayed with the Ford Studio?
Yeah.
Working for him?
I think at that time there were two things. John Reinhardt.
Ah, yes.
At the Ford Studio exterior.
Mm-hmm.
And... Then he left to go to Continental to do some of work on the Continental, mm-hmm. and Don Della Rosa went from Lincoln Mercury to the Ford exterior studio,
mm-hmm.
lateral move.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked for Don for a short time.
Did you?
Then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How did you find Don as a superior or as a supervisor?
Don was a nice nice guy.
Mm-hmm. Was he a good designer?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think he was tops.
Mm-hmm.
I really do. He designed, and I don't think he had that much of a background in it. But he designed well by the seat of his pants and did a fantastic job of full-size renderings.
Really? That was his forte, huh?
Yeah. So... anyway, during that time, we used to work on front ends and back ends and the tail. You can't imagine how much work was done on just getting a grill approved back in those days.
Can you describe that?
Yeah, because you had carryover sheet metal. As I said, you were in a three-year cycle. You had carryover sheet metal, which means carryover roof, doors, and fenders, and deck. Everything was carried over, but you usually did a side view change of chrome moldings that were different, and a headlight grill concept that was new, and you did taillights and ornamentations between the taillights.
Mm-hmm.
And these are things you worked on for the 2 year after the original car was out, mm-hmm. like the 52, then you worked on a new grill, and taillights, mm-hmm. and you changed them.
Was it immutable in those days that it was a three-year run for the car with only minor facelifts?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
that was usually the deal on all those.
Mm-hmm.
If you think back, that's about where we were.
Mm-hmm.
But the work involved was extensive. We'd have shows every week on grills and so on, and show them over and over and over again.
Until approved final
yeah,
approval was given.
Right, mm-hmm. right. And if you, back in those days, you could do, as far as I know, 1 year for a Ford front end. I think we worked and did something like 97 different grills.
You mean different sketches or renderings?
Well, they actually mock up. They actually did them in clay. From the sketch into
I
the
see.
Clay. And I think I can recall that we did a analysis of how many grills got to, I think it was a 54 Ford. How many grills did we do? And there's just scads and scads. I think 97.
97, incomplete to, from initial...
Clay to...
from initial sketch.
Clay to foil.
From initial sketch to rendering...
To the clay.
To clay to foil.
Yeah.
Which meant the final...
Yeah.
The final clay.
Right.
Mock-up.
Because
97 in 1 week?
No, in a year.
In the year, I'm sorry, yeah.
But every week we'd show at least three or four grills.
Four grills.
Yeah.
This seems awfully painstaking.
That's right.
What was the need for that? Can you look back and say, why did we do
why did we do so many? That's what you always do, because the fact that nowadays economics says it's ridiculous to do that many.
Right.
So anyway, I don't know whether it was that to keep five guys busy or indecision, or a change of management, topside, or just what. I can't tell you. But even for the side trim, we do so many of them, and go through the thing. We'd show maybe 25 or 30 side moldings on a car.
Who would you show these to?
Our product planning in those days. I think I've forgotten when Lee came into the thing, but.
Lee.
Chase Morrissey was in the thing, and
Iacocca,
yeah, that's what I'm talking about. But Chase Morrissey.
Morrissey
was in the thing before Lee, and trying to think of back on who did come into the thing, but
you're talking about chief product planners.
Yeah.
Okay.
I
wouldn't they be getting tired of seeing these minutely detailed changes?
I would think so.
It seems incredible that
that's right.
To me, an outsider,
yep.
Why would they want so many minute changes?
That's right.
But I guess there was a point where you
and we work overtime doing these things, sometimes until all night. Some of the modelers would model these grills all night. There's a modeler from the trade school that Bud came over to the design center called Benny Barbera, and Benny worked in the Ford studio at that time and would work all night on the just getting the grill ready for. Management.
B-A-R-B-E-R-A.
Yeah. So, anyway, that at that time I was, I think, a senior designer.
About
1954? Yeah, in 54 I went into the interior studio as an assistant section supervisor.
Under
Art Querfeld. And Art and I, had all the Ford and trucks and so on, maybe instrument panels and soft trim, both. And we had a large department. I think we had to about 20 designers, 10 on each side. And we used to do, at that time, a total of sometimes 5 instrument panels going at once for the Ford or Mercury or whatever. You never settled on one. You'd show them 5. And
every Friday? Was that today?
Yeah.
That was show and tell day.
Show and tell. You showed some item, whether it's a steering wheel or an instrument panel. In those days, as you know, in 1953, Ford became very safety-oriented. It started the first... I give them credit. They had a safety engineering group that used to... come and tell us about safety steering wheels. Previous to that, we'd have all kinds of designs with sharp centers and the knobs would be sharp and so on. And we as designers didn't exactly like what was going on safety-wise because it meant we had to do kind of unexciting, flat, dull things. But by the same token, I think it was a wise thing. But in 53 and 54, we got into that safety aspect of the instrument panels and so on. And I think in 53 and 4, we started putting crash pads on the instrument panel.
As
an option.
You're talking about production cars?
Yes.
Or in the studios?
Well, you ended up in production, but
I think the
55 or something.
56 was
56,
the first
yeah. But we were working 2 years in advance.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I wanted to know where did this impetus come from? Had there been a top level decision to begin as early as 1953 to begin to make the car
safer?
Safer.
You bet.
Good.
Mm-hmm. I don't think the public really knows the how we got into that, and I think Ford was a pioneer in that.
Do you remember? Can you pinpoint anybody who was the chief exponent of making cars safer at Ford in 53, 54? Obviously, this is...
Trying to think of this engineer that It'll probably come as we go. But anyway, at that time, it was tested and said we needed a 2-inch pad to on the instrument panel because they, some of them are, the shape of them is sharp.
Actually, the dashboard.
Yeah, well.
Yeah. What is the exact nomenclature?
Dashboard is where your feet go, and it is the panel that separates the engine to the driver's compartment. The dash is the old-time dash where it came up and from the floorboard up, and then you put instruments on it. But
so the, it's the dash instrument panel, we don't
like to talk about dash. I think that's a wrong term. It's a guy says, "How's your dash panel?" Well, it's really not the dash panel because that's behind the instrument panel.
I see. The dashboard is actually behind the
instrument
panel.
That's right.
And you don't see it.
Right.
Okay, good. So it's the
This has always been a mistake. When you write anything up on this thing, you've got to say instrument panel.
Instrument panel.
And the general guy says, "How's your dash panel?" Well,
wrong.
That's wrong.
Yeah. Now then, what is the area above the instrument panel that is padded? Is that still
that's the instrument panel?
Okay,
right.
But that's, that whole place is...
That is all instrument panel.
Okay, fine. So you had to put
We had to do two models in clay.
Uh-huh.
One with a pad and one without.
Well, what was the object of that?
Because at that time, all the safety things, such as, I think, seat belts, and I think at, in 56, I think they...